in documents published last December, where ALEC was boasting, in essence, that these provisions were a part of their agenda because they wanted to basically punish what they called free riders or freeloaders, who are people who use solar panels who put energy back into the grid. And so this is a step forward for ALEC's agenda. It's a step backward for our country and for solar energy to have this provision pass in Oklahoma. And it really is, you know, a terrible bill that passed. But we're not surprised in Oklahoma, quite frankly. Oklahoma, if you've ever been to their state capital, as our research director Nick Sergey has, they have actually, in essence, allowed corporations to buy the Capitol, literally, or at least pay for part of the Capitol. Engraved within the rotunda of the Capitol, Oklahoma, is Halliburton and the names of other corporations that helped fund a rebuilding of that Capitol.
And Lisa Graves, can you talk about what the impact of the Wisconsin voter ID ruling will have on other states with similar bills?
Well, I'm hopeful that other judges will take the advice, in essence, the analysis, the really excellent analysis of Judge Lynn Edelman, who's a federal district court judge in Milwaukee, who issued this ruling. It's a really powerful decision. It goes through step by step and really talks about the lack of evidence, the absolute lack of evidence of fraud that would be prevented by these laws. He talks about how the current penalties are so stiff. It's a $10,000 fine and a 3-year prison sentence if someone does impersonate another voter, that's enough of a penalty. And really the lack of foundation for these laws, as well as the impact on people. There was testimony in the case before the judge showing how this law would affect American citizens who want to vote. There are other states, nearly a dozen states, where these voter ID restrictions have passed. And so I'm hoping that in other states, if those provisions are challenged in court, that other judges will look to this really excellent, thorough analysis of the federal court judge in Milwaukee.
And very briefly, Lisa, if you can talk about this merging of your organizations, the Center for Media and Democracy and Progressive.
Well, we're super excited to announce this month that the Center for Media and Democracy and the Progressive Inc. have merged. We've joined forces. We have a work to do to integrate our operations. But it's a really exciting time for us. We're both independent, investigative and media organizations in Madison, Wisconsin. The Progressive has a tremendous history going back to 1909. It has been the place of some of the best writing, I think, in our country.
Lisa, we're going to have to leave it there, but I thank you for being with us. President of Progressive Inc. And that does it for our show. I'll be speaking at Dartmouth College on Friday, May 2nd at 5 o'clock at Moore Hall. Go to our website, democracynow.org, for more details. And on May 17th in Stowe, Vermont. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Renee Feltz, Aaron Mate, Nermeen Sheikh, Steve Martinez, Sam Alkafani, Masood Rabi, Karen Dina, Gazdari, Amy Littlefield, Cassandra Lazare, Messiah Rhodes, and Sharina Ndura. Miguel Nagara and Mike DeFilippo are engineers. Special thanks to Becca Staley, Julie Crosby, Hugh Grant, Jessica Lee, John Wallach, Vesta Gadars, Brenda Murad. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh for another edition of Democracy Now!
You are listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM Portland, 91.9 FM Hood River in the Gorge, 104.3 FM Philomath and Corvallis. Up next, the evening news.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the Pete Seeger Tribute and Sing-Along on Saturday, May 3rd, from 3 to 10 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater. On what would have been Pete Seeger's 95th birthday, his life and legacy will be honored with song, remembrances, and a talk by Joe Hickerson. Again, that's Saturday, May 3rd, at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton in Portland. More information is available at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
Friday, May 2nd, 12 noon to 1:30, I will be featuring the music of Lori Lewis. The San Francisco Bay Area was a hotbed of traditional and acoustic music beginning in the 1960s. Starting with the Arkansas Sheiks and the Good Old Persons, she then started her own band, the Grant Street String Band. For the last dozen years, she and her partner, Tom Rosen, have fronted her band, always attracting the highest quality musicians. Blending traditional and contemporary material, she has forged a unique sound. a limited number of One Evening in May, her brand new CD, will be available as a thank you gift for your membership. Tune in Friday, May 2nd, 12 noon to 1:30.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Portland's Gay Yellow Pages, providing a resource guide of openly gay-friendly businesses, organizations, and services since 1996. New smartphone app available for all iPhones and Droids. For more information, you can visit pdxgyp.com.
This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Gazelle Natural Fiber Clothing and Full Circle Resale. Full Circle accepts light, new, natural fiber clothing, jewelry, and accessories for consignment or store credit. Gazelle and Full Circle Resale are both located at the corner of Northeast 41st and Fremont and on the web at gazellenaturalfiberclothing.com or fullcirclereleaseportland.com.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, an oil train derailment in Virginia brings attention to the lack of accountability for oil train tracking in Oregon.
Critics challenge the death penalty after a botched execution in Oklahoma last night.
Local activists gear up for the annual May Day rally for workers' rights tomorrow in downtown Portland.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, April 30th, 2014. I'm Brian Pritchett.
And I'm Aaron J. Bernard. A Native American activist group called Eradicating Offensive Native Masketry is planning to protest Nike over the use of Indian mascots. They will be asking Nike to stop producing and selling items with mascots such as Chief Wahoo, which appears on some team caps and jerseys. Group co-founder Jackie Keeler stated that she feels these logos and mascots hinder people's ability to see Native Americans as human beings, and that they only help promote negative stereotypes of Native people. Keeler said, quote, "We want to make red face finally unacceptable, the way black face and yellow face is unacceptable," end quote. The protest is scheduled to take place tomorrow at 8 a.m. at Nike headquarters in Beaverton.
A Klamath Falls business has been found guilty of failing to protect two of its Guatemalan and Hispanic employees from racial discrimination. Maltby Biocontrol Incorporated has been ordered by the Bureau of Labor and Industries to pay $200,000 to the affected workers for what the agency called abusive treatment, race discrimination, and retaliation. The complaints orbit around the behavior of a father and two sons who are employed at Maltby. According to the agency, James Bassett attacked another employee and hit him in the chest. The employee reported the incident to his supervisor, Lewis Bassett Sr., who is James Bassett's father. The employee then filed criminal charges for which he says he faced retaliation. James Bassett also reportedly fired pistols and called out racial slurs to other employees on company property. A second son, Lewis Bassett Jr., is also implicated in the case. Both of the Bassett sons and a third unidentified employee allegedly beat another employee with a bat. The company is being censured for failing to control a hostile and racist employee, as well as retaliating against a worker who filed criminal charges, according to State Labor Commissioner Brad Avakian. Avakian said, "No worker should have to fear violence, endure racial slurs, or face retaliation for contacting law enforcement when attacked by a racist coworker."
Plans for the annual May Day March and Rally in Portland are taking form as a broad range of community organizations and labor advocacy groups, including local unions, prepare to celebrate International Workers' Day. For more, KBOO's Susan Cecil spoke with Greg Margolis, who is helping to organize tomorrow's rally and march for workers in Portland.
What does International Workers' Day Rally and March for People Over Profit mean?
What it means is that workers are the ones who do all of the work that keep us healthy and alive in this world, and we should be celebrating workers. But in society, and especially in the American society, there's been an emphasis on making money and profit and not on the best interests of human beings. That answers your question in regard to why we're calling it people over profit, because we think that our resources should be used for the good of human beings and the good of the planet rather than to make rich people richer.
What is the plan for tomorrow?
The plan for tomorrow is that people will start gathering at the South Park blocks, which is Southwest Salmon and Southwest Park in downtown Portland. They'll gather at 2 p.m. and during that time set up for a rally that will start at 3 p.m. And then at the rally, there will be speakers and there will be music. And then we'll start marching through downtown Portland at 4 p.m. And the march will last about an hour or an hour and a half. And we'll come back to the park blocks to do a closing rally. And before the rally, there'll be some music and entertainment. There'll be tables there for people to learn more about different organizations and the work that they're doing towards workers' rights and social justice. And it'll be an opportunity for people to both celebrate the idea of International Workers' Day, but also to protest the system, the corporate capitalist system that is taking wealth away from working people and giving it to the very rich. And we're looking for a more equitable society where everybody has their needs met.
What are some of the issues faced by workers in the Portland area?
Many workers are unrepresented by a union and don't have the power to affect the way they're paid, their working conditions, and their benefits. Many workers are forced to work part-time where they can't make it for low wages, where they can't make enough money to feed their families or to even pay a mortgage or pay rent. And even organized and union workers are under attack by contracts that are less and less, have less and less good benefits and living wages. So workers at all level, both organized workers who are in unions and unorganized low-wage workers like at fast food stores or restaurants or other places where they're not represented, they're all under attack, and it's getting more and more difficult to be able to make a living wage where you can even have a home, let alone, you know, even rent a place, let alone have your own home. Recently, the Portland Association of Teachers, which is the union that represents the teachers in the Portland area, was having a contract negotiations to try to get a fair contract where not only were they paid reasonable wages and got decent benefits, but where there were reduced class sizes so that they could really teach their students, because many of the class sizes are much too big to give a quality education. When you have 35 or 40 students, you can't give them any individual attention. And you're spending more and more time just grading papers rather than teaching. And it's unfair to the students and to the teachers. So during these negotiations, the community built up support for the teachers in case they were going to go out on strike. And the teachers threatened to go out on strike. And just by the threat of that and because of the community support, they were able to get a decent contract, and they were able to add, I believe, 150 extra teachers when the district had originally said they were only going to add 70 or 80. So because of community support, there was a lot of success in those negotiations. And the teachers will, teachers and students and families will be at May Day to celebrate those kinds of victories, but also to recognize the need for continued struggle for all workers.
At 4 p.m., a march will begin through downtown Portland and will end back at the South Park blocks at about 5:30 p.m. If you can't make it downtown, be sure to tune in to the KBOO News tomorrow at 5 for a special May Day Live report. That's beginning at 2 p.m. tomorrow.
And now we hear the latest in worker-related news from our friends at laborradio.org.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. A vote to raise the minimum wage is expected as soon as Wednesday in the U.S. Senate. Republicans in Congress, though, continue to successfully block an increase in the federal minimum wage. Currently at $7.25 an hour, Democrats want to raise it to $10.10 an hour by 2016. The Congressional Budget Office estimates that raising that minimum wage would help 16.5 million U.S. workers, but would also likely eliminate around 500,000 jobs. 21 U.S. states have minimum wages higher than the federal rate. In a video advocating raising the minimum wage posted online, retail worker Philip Morgan describes what it's like trying to get by on a minimum wage.
Half my money goes to rent, and I'm diabetic, so the next big chunk of my money goes to medicine. And then there's food and transportation, and then I have nothing left. That's it.
The California Federation of Teachers is boycotting Staples to protest Postal Service privatization of retail mail service at the office supply store chain. The teachers won't buy any school supplies from Staples. The American Postal Workers Union requested the action. APWU sees the U.S. Postal Service deal with Staples as a privatization move that destroys good-paying union postal jobs. A coalition of four postal unions are banding together to fight the Staples deal, and the loss of postal jobs and degradation of mail service, the unions say, goes along with privatization. A coalition of 14 Detroit public worker unions, including AFSCME, says an agreement reached with the city offers an opportunity for the unions to provide regular input and guidance to city managers over the next 5 years. The agreement covers 3,500 workers. Full details of the deal haven't yet been released. Public safety unions are not in the coalition. The police and fire unions in Detroit have yet to reach a new deal with the city as Detroit's bankruptcy proceeds in court. Ed McNeil, spokesman for the Coalition of Detroit Unions, says Detroit's emergency manager Kevin Orr is privatizing Detroit public services like garbage collection and water and sewer operations, even though privatization too often proves ineffective. The Association of Flight Attendants, CWA, and the Association of Professional Flight Attendants are in negotiations with the merged American Airlines. Talks will continue for 150 days in an effort to reach agreement on a joint new contract for 24,000 flight attendants. American has announced record profits. A new agreement is expected to be in place by 2015. Meanwhile, AFA-CWA has elected new leaders. Sarah Nelson is the new president of the union. Deborah Sutor was elected vice president. On Wednesday, the AFL-CIO will project a 90-by-60-foot anti-deportation piece of art onto its building in Washington, D.C. to highlight the deportation crisis impact on immigrant workers. The projection will contain the names and stories of deported immigrant workers. The AFL-CIO supports comprehensive immigration reform with a path to citizenship and an end to the deportations that rip apart immigrant worker families.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
A new group of southwestern Washington lawmakers want to form a coalition to see if there is another way to erect an Interstate 5 bridge across the Columbia River. They have sent a letter to their counterparts in Oregon inviting them to form a group to be called the Bi-State Bridge Coalition to explore an Interstate 5 bridge replacement project. Washington leaders will host a June 4th meeting to explore corridors between Portland and southwest Washington. The meeting will be closed to the public and the press.
An oil train derailed today in Lynchburg, Virginia, causing fireballs to explode into the air and crude oil to spill into the James River. No injuries were reported, but some residents and businesses nearby have been evacuated. At least three of the 15 rail cars were punctured, spilling an unknown quantity of crude oil into the river. The train is operated by CSX Freight Company. Authorities say they've contained the fire, but are not using any extinguishing materials to put the fire out because of concerns about other materials that might be on the train. CSX issued a statement that the situation was under control, but did not release any information on what materials were in the tanker cars other than crude oil. In a follow-up to a related local story, the hunt for which government agency has information on the location and amount of oil traveling through Oregon by train continued today, when the Federal Surface Transportation Board returned a call to KBOO News. The board said that they are not responsible for tracking information on oil shipments by train through Oregon. On Monday, KBOO reporters contacted the Oregon Department of Transportation, who said that the State Office of Emergency Management were the ones responsible for that information. The Office of Emergency Management insisted that it was the Federal Transportation Division, who then said it was the Surface Transportation Board. We now have confirmation from the Surface Transportation Board that they are not the ones responsible for tracking oil trains through Oregon. They suggested that we contact the Oregon Department of Transportation, the agency we originally contacted in our fruitless attempt to determine who exactly tracks the shipment of oil through the state of Oregon by train.
It's been almost a year since a freight train carrying a shipment of crude oil through Quebec, Canada, derailed, caught fire, and exploded. 42 people were killed in that disaster, and now some city officials are asking whether Portland might be similarly at risk. Almost 20,000 barrels of oil are shipped through Portland by rail car on an annual basis. That's up considerably from 200 barrels in 2008. And some officials are concerned that these increasing shipments may pose hazards to humans as well as to the environment. A group of agencies and emergency response officials discussed the issue at an interagency rail safety meeting in Linton, Oregon this week. Concern over oil fires on the rail cars was raised as one potential hazard. If an oil fire broke out along Portland's train tracks, it would require foam dousing, said Portland Fire and Rescue's Tommy Schroeder. Schroeder added that traditionally equipped fire trucks simply don't have the capacity to battle this type of blaze. The trucks only carry 20 gallons of foam retardant on average, and the fire department estimates that it would take 2,500 gallons of foam to douse four burning oil cars. Senator Betsy Johnson said she feels confident that the economic benefits of shipping oil through the city outweigh the hazards, and that the hazards themselves can be mitigated. The freight shipping companies responsible for transporting the bulk of the oil through Portland and Vancouver say that the process is safe, and that they have the technology to spot trouble early if issues do arrive. Not everyone was convinced. A small group of demonstrators, including representatives from Columbia Riverkeeper, also showed up to the meeting to voice their concerns about the dangers of rail-based oil shipping in the Pacific Northwest.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an interview with Saeed Banoura of the International Middle East Media Center about the failed Palestinian-Israeli peace talks and the issue of Palestinian prisoners, followed by Occupy Radio at 6 o'clock. Tonight's show is an installment from Air Occupy, produced by Ormond Beach, Florida. At 7 o'clock, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Stay tuned at 8 o'clock for Ditch Digger Radio for an eclectic slum of garbage, garage, R&B, doo-wop, soul, and early blues, as well as random field recordings, clips from public access TV, and mysterious guest hosts. Tomorrow's weather will be hot and sunny, just like today, with a high of 88 and a 0% chance of rain. Happy May Day, everyone. Our friends at radcast.org have stopped producing daily radiation counts due to a lack of volunteer support. If you are interested in helping with this citizen-led radiation count, contact the organizers at radcast.org. Say in history, in 1952, the diary of Anne Frank, a Jewish victim of the Holocaust, was first published in English. Her diary became one of the most popular books in the world and is included in most schools' recommended reading. The diary provides a disturbing account of a teenager living in hiding with seven others in fear of their lives in occupied Holland. Anne Frank died of typhus just before her 16th birthday in the Bergen-Belsen concentration camp in 1945. Our quote of the day today comes from Saul Alinsky's Rules for Radicals, wherein he writes, "As an organizer, I start where the world is as it is, not as I would like it to be."
It's 5:23, time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
What's the matter with the post office? The U.S. Postal Service, I mean, the corporate hierarchy that runs this enormously popular public institution. Yes, I know that USPS has lost revenue it traditionally got from first-class mail delivery, but I also know that letter carriers and postal workers have offered many excellent ideas for expanding the services that USPS can deliver, thus increasing both revenue and the importance of maintaining these community treasures. Yet, the Postal Board of Governors, which includes corporate interests that would profit by killing the public service, seems intent on, guess what, killing it. The board's only idea is to cut services and shut down hundreds of local post offices. Incredibly, their list of closures include the historic post office in Philadelphia's Old City, the very building where Ben Franklin presided as our country's first Postmaster General, appointed by the Continental Congress in 1775. All across the country, post offices that are invaluable artistic and historic assets are slated to be sold to developers. One is the marvelous 1935 Bronx Post Office, with classical architectural flourishes and 13 museum-worthy murals. "It's not just a post office," says one customer fighting the closure. "It's part of my life." No one feels that way about a FedEx warehouse. Yet, says a USPS spokeswoman dismissively, the four-story building is severely underused. This is Jim Hightower saying, so use it. Put a coffee shop in it, a public internet facility, a library and museum, a one-stop government services center, and, as USPS employees have suggested, a public bank offering basic services to the thousands of neighborhood people ignored by commercial banks. Come on, USPS, show a little creativity and gumption, and remember that service is a key part of your name.
To get more of Jim Hightower's populist take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to, visit www.hightowerlowdown.org.
Laws and bans surrounding the controversial use of e-cigarettes are being implemented in multiple American cities, including Chicago and New York. These bans, along with a measure in the city of Chicago, have sparked debate with health officials, the e-cigarette industry, and its users. Federal regulators claim they are forcing the laws because they don't want e-smoking to become a social norm or a gateway leading teens to try more harmful substances such as cigarettes or chewable tobacco. Owners of multiple e-cigarette businesses say the marketing and labeling of their products as e-cigarettes have given lawmakers a misconstrued perception of what the products actually are. They also say that the regulations will make it harder for ex-smokers and people trying to find another way to smoke, as these people will be confined to the same designated smoking areas for people smoking tobacco cigarettes. Robin Cavall, chief executive of the anti-smoking organization Legacy Foundation, says even though the ingredients in e-cigs are safer than many found in regular cigarettes, they still contain the addictive chemical nicotine. The National Institute of Health says nicotine can be a very harmful substance if a user is exposed to the liquid while inserting it into the e-cigarette. Cavall said that his organization wants a generation of Americans where, for them, cigarettes are a thing of the past, an artifact like a roll of film or a rotary telephone.
A botched execution in Oklahoma last night left a man writhing in pain on a gurney for 20 minutes before he died of a heart attack. A second execution, also scheduled for last night in Oklahoma, was called off, and a new execution date has been set for 2 weeks from now. The state of Oklahoma has pushed forward with executions of prisoners despite a lack of the poison needed to carry out lethal injections. The federal government ordered the state to reveal the source of its execution drugs, but Oklahoma has refused to release the information. Instead, the state scheduled two executions in a single night. The first one went terribly wrong, and Clayton Lockett writhed in pain for 14 minutes before the warden decided to call off the execution. But the lethal drugs were already in Lockett's system, and he died of a heart attack a few minutes later. The botched execution follows a similar case in Ohio several months ago, in which a condemned prisoner writhed and grimaced in pain for 15 minutes before he was declared dead. Critics of the death penalty point to the constitutional ban on cruel and unusual punishment, as well as the well-documented fact that executions do not lead to lower crime rates, as well as costing states hundreds of thousands and often millions of dollars, a much higher cost than keeping dangerous inmates in prison for life. The former superintendent of the Oregon State Penitentiary recently came out in opposition to the death penalty, along with current Governor John Kitzhaber, who imposed a moratorium on executions until he leaves office next year. At a recent event in Portland, author Jen Marlowe spoke at a commemoration of the execution of Troy Davis in Georgia 3 years ago. The evidence of Davis's innocence was overwhelming, but the state of Georgia decided to execute him anyway.
I got involved in the case because I saw Martinez speak on Democracy Now! Right after Troy survived his first execution date, which was in 2007, which was one of four execution dates. The fourth one was when they ultimately got him, but he survived three previous execution dates. And when I heard Martinez speak about her double struggle, how she was fighting for her own life, having been diagnosed with terminal breast cancer in 2001, at that time given 6 months to live, that was 2001. Now we're in 2007 when I'm hearing Martinez speak, and she's talking about fighting for her own life so that she could raise her son and continue to fight for her brother's life. And I sat up and I paid attention because you could not hear Martinez speak without sitting up and paying attention. And I wanted to know more about this brother whose innocence she was fighting so hard to prove, and dug up some information online, the Amnesty International report that was published in February 2007 called Where is the Justice for Me? And this report laid it all out, some of the things that you heard Kim just mention now, the fact that there was no physical evidence that ever linked Troy to the murder of the police officer, the fact that the entire case against Troy was based on eyewitness testimony, yet seven out of those nine eyewitnesses later recanted or contradicted their testimony, the fact that one of the remaining two witnesses who had not recanted actually was the person who had gone into the police station the day after the murder and said, oh, I can give you the name of who did it, because the police had no idea who did it, and gave them the name Troy Davis. And that new witnesses since came forward and actually implicated that very man as someone who had either confessed the crime to them or that they had seen him pull the trigger. And as I, you know, read all this evidence and my jaw dropped. At that time, I thought that this must be an exceptional travesty of justice. What I didn't realize is that it's actually a very ordinary travesty of justice, and that so many aspects of Troy's case, including the very ones I just detailed, are what make his case emblematic of a broken system. And I want to be clear that I consider the death penalty the sharp edge and the highest stakes consequence of a much larger broken criminal justice system, which really is, I would say, a human rights crisis in this country. And I wrote a note to Troy in prison, and that's how it started. He wrote back and forth, we corresponded, we became friends. He introduced me to Martina. Martina was coming out to Seattle, where I live. There Troy sat in what only could be described as his cage on George's death row, because that's what we do, right? We cage human beings. We cage 2 million of them right now in this country. So Troy was sitting in his cage, and he was connecting me to his other friend in Seattle, a woman named Megan. He's connecting the two of us, and he's connecting both of us to Martina, who's coming out to Seattle. So here he is, creating this web of human connections, all sitting in his cage in Jackson, Georgia, on death row. And when Martina came to Seattle, and she just happened to mention, well, people tell me I should write a book, but, you know, gosh, I've never, you know, I don't have time to write a book. I'd need someone to help me to write it with me. And I immediately volunteered. At that point, I was so invested in Troy's struggle and in Troy's story that I was prepared to do whatever I could, lend whatever skills I might have to be able to further that cause. And the book came out in this past September, which September 21st is when it was released, which was the two-year anniversary of when Georgia managed to kill Troy. But Georgia never managed to kill the fight that Troy was fighting and the fight that Martina was fighting. In fact, by Georgia's shameful act of executing Troy, what they ended up doing was mobilizing all of us to fight even stronger, to fight even harder, and to shout even louder in Troy's name. And all I can hope is that I am Troy Davis, Troy and Martina's story, and Martina passed away 2 months after Troy was killed. She outlived her prognosis by a full 10 years, but she passed away shortly after Troy was killed. And all I can hope is that their book does justice to their story, to their struggle, and to the larger struggle to end the death penalty.
That was Jen Marlowe speaking recently at an event in Portland. Her new book, I Am Troy Davis, documents the case of one of the most well-known prisoners to be executed in the U.S. despite evidence of his innocence. A study released this week found that at least 1 in 25 of the people sentenced to death in the U.S. are innocent.
This morning on KBOO's Air Cascadia, Noelle Hanrahan of Prison Radio spoke about how she got involved in the issue of prison reform.
I came across things that we often don't sort of really take in or let sink in. The fact that 1 in 36 people in this country are going to do prison time, and that 1 in 99 are actually in prison and 1 in 33 are under correctional control. Now, those kinds of numbers, they're just numbers, but they totally define what's possible in the culture. Because once you make that commitment to prisons, and the culture is pretty criminogenic, like the culture creates crime, the way in which we build prisons and we enact laws and regulate people's behavior, that is all creating more crime, because we have the most crime and we have the most violence and we have the largest criminal population, prison population. So that whole nut really says a lot about where the culture is going, and it's happened in our lifetime.
And what color are those prisoners? I know you know this, but, you know, most of those prisoners are not white folks.
Yeah, it's, you know, I have an African-American son, and I know that 1 in 3 African-American men will go to prison. All right, so this is just unbelievably definitive for our entire culture. And so Prison Radio, our thing, is to try and get these voices, people on death row, people in solitary, people in immigration detention, people who are wrongfully convicted, people who have health issues, we're talking about hepatitis, we're talking about AIDS in prison, get those kinds of voices into the public debate. Because if people had more information, that's why we're losing access to all of our ability to have newspapers and real news, not fake news, not like the news cycle of the down jetliner. I mean, really, we need news and we need investigative reporters and we need our community partners, community radio stations, to tell the truth. And we need listeners to honor the fact that they have the radio stations, because that's the only way that we're going to actually educate people enough so that we can change some of these decisions that have been ruling our culture. And, you know, we've lived in a very dramatic 30-year period where we went from 300,000 prisoners to over 2.3 million. That just happened in our lifetime in a few decades. So that has to be reversed. So, you know, 10, 15 years ago, I wasn't so into abolition. I am so now into abolition, because there just has to be radically revisioned.
That was Noelle Hanrahan of Prison Radio speaking this morning on KBOO. More information can be found on her website, prisonradio.org.
And now the latest news and developments from the occupied territories in Palestine from the International Middle East Media Center in Bethlehem.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center, www.imemc.org, for Wednesday, April 30th, 2014. Israeli army demolished 2 Palestinian homes and kidnapped civilians during invasions targeting West Bank communities. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. The Israeli army demolished 2 Palestinian homes in Al-Arub refugee camp near the southern West Bank city of Hebron on Wednesday. According to local sources, several heavy vehicles invaded the area, including farmlands, fired civil gas bombs and concussion grenades at residents, and demolished 2 homes. The homes are more than 200 square meters each. The soldiers also demolished wells around the property and uprooted olive and fig trees and grapevines. Earlier on Wednesday at dawn, Israeli military vehicles invaded various Palestinian communities in occupied West Bank, searched homes and kidnapped several Palestinians. Home searches and kidnappings were reported in Hebron and Bethlehem cities in southern West Bank, as well as the northern West Bank city of Nablus. Also on Wednesday, the Israeli army handed over the body of Imad Awadallah, 48, and his 46-year-old brother Adil to Palestinian officials at a checkpoint in the northern West Bank. Both brothers, who were Hamas fighters, were killed by Israeli troops back in 1998. Their funeral was attended by thousands in the central West Bank city of Ramallah on Wednesday midday. In other news, 5 Israeli soldiers were injured on Wednesday evening near the southern West Bank city of Hebron. Army sources said that their military jeep rolled over at the main road near the town of Idna. The 5 soldiers sustained light wounds and were moved to an Israeli hospital for treatment. And that's all for today from Dime EMC News. This was the Wednesday, April 30th, 2014, news roundup from the occupied Palestinian territories. For more news and updates, please visit our website at www.imemc.org. Today's report has been brought to you by George Shmawi and me, Ghassan Bannoura.
The deadline previously set by Washington for a peace deal in the Middle East expired on Tuesday, with the peace deal in ruins. Analysts say the collapse was a result of Israel's continuous construction of settlements on lands that are subject to negotiations. Figures published Tuesday by settlement watchdog Peace Now showed that while negotiations were underway, the Israeli government approved plans for nearly 14,000 new settler homes. We'll have a full report with analysis on the reasons for the collapse later in the hour with Saeed Banoura of the International Middle East Media Center. Stay tuned after this newscast for that interview on KBOO News in Depth.
In spite of Russian assurances that their troops had been withdrawn from the border with Ukraine, NATO officials indicate that there has been no sign of movement. Tens of thousands of Russian troops have not returned to their permanent positions from which they started drills last week. NATO continues to urge the Russians to abide by the Geneva Convention. Meanwhile, Russia's foreign minister harshly criticized the new U.S. restrictions on high-tech exports to Russia, resulting from Washington's latest Ukraine-related sanctions. The White House has said it will deny export licenses on any high-technology export that will contribute to Russian military capabilities and revoke any existing licenses. These restrictions will affect high-tech cooperation between the two countries, including the launching of satellites, which could impact joint space exploration.
Produce newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Aaron J. Bernard and Susan Cecil. Special thanks to Chris Andre and Karen James. Our engineer is Ian Westmoreland. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Jenka Soderberg. A podcast of local stories from this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. Or look for us on Twitter at KBOO News. If you would like to call your elected representatives about any issue you've heard about on the news tonight, here are their phone numbers, so grab something to write with. The local number for Senator Ron Wyden is 503-326-7525. The number for Senator Jeff Merkley is 503-326-3386. And Portland Mayor Charlie Hales can be reached at 503-823-4120. You are listening to KBOO Portland at 90.7 FM, on K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR in Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Brian Pritchett.
And I'm Aaron J. Bernard. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO. At 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, on Voices from the Edge with Joanne Hardesty, we have This Last Minute Change. Greg Palast has had to cancel his interview, so sitting in for him will be author and former economic hitman John Perkins, who will talk about world politics, including the Ukraine and Russia. At 9 on Press Watch, it's May Day. Provoking the only major opposing nuclear power, ignoring the climate storm disaster, and a list of 10 ridiculous things for conformists to swallow on The News You're Not Supposed to Know. At 9:30 on Fight the Empire, host Per Fagreng speaks with John Michael Greer, author of Decline and Fall, The End of Empire and the Future of Democracy in 21st Century America. At 10 on Air Cascadia, City Repair founder Mark Lakeman joins host Chris Andre to talk about the 2014 Village Buildant Convergence. At 11 on Between the Covers, host Sarika Mehta speaks with Salem lawyer and author Michael Pacheco about his new collection of angels, demons, and chopped chorizo. And at 11:30 on Black Book Talk, host Patricia Welsh, Emma Jackson Ford, and O.B. Hill interview award-winning young adult author Sharon Draper about her work. Thanks, KBOO members, for your generous support. Not a member? Well, the time to change that is now. Membership drive starts on May Day. Celebrate and support.
KBOO News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
By Saeed Bonora, the editor-in-chief of the International Middle East Media Center, the website imemc.org. And I understand that you have just published a document on the current state of prisoners that are being held in Israel, Palestinian prisoners, and I wonder if you can talk a little bit about that document.
Well, thank you. First, the document was prepared by a well-known Palestinian researcher and former political prisoner, Abdel Nasser Sirwana, who also heads the Census Department at the Palestinian Ministry of Detainees. And it was submitted actually today in Arabic and in English after we at the IMEMC, I myself translated it. It was submitted to the to a conference in Beirut, Lebanon. That conference, you know, many figures and officials attended that conference. Around 300 persons attended that conference, including Arab and international leaders and figures attended it. One of them was former Attorney General of the United States, Ramsey Clark, and of course Fadwa Barghouti, the wife of detained Fatah leader, imprisoned leader Marwan Barghouti.
And what are some of the findings about the current situation of the Palestinian prisoners?
Unfortunately, you know, whenever there are reports about Palestinian detainees, it's always it's like always there is nothing good to report on their situation because they are facing constant harassment, constant abuse, and denied their basic rights, including their fundamental right of, you know, to medical treatment. Some of the findings of the report is that we have, since 1967, approximately 800,000 Palestinians, including 15,000 women, and dozens of thousands of children, have been kidnapped by the army since 1967. And if we talk about since the election, the Intifada started in late September of 2000, the number of Palestinians kidnapped and imprisoned by the army is more than 80,000 Palestinians, including nearly 10,000 children and more than 60 former and current ministers and legislators democratically elected by the Palestinian people.
I understand that there was an incident just this week of a lawyer who was imprisoned by Israel from Jerusalem, who was released after being tortured for several months and ended up committing suicide this week. Can you talk about that?
Unfortunately, you know, we know what kind of torture the Palestinian prisoners face when they are imprisoned. The level of excessive and extreme torture that they go through, many of those detainees have actually been killed during torture, due to torture, and others have been shot and killed by the arresting officers. This lawyer was found dead in his apartment after, you know, being tortured for more than 45 days by the Israeli forces. And then when he was released, he apparently committed suicide in his place. His name was Amjad Safadi, and he's 39 years old.
And just today, there's a report that your news agency put out about a Palestinian prisoner, Adnan Shanaita, 25-year-old, who has been moved to the hospital and is part of a long-term hunger strike. He's on the 38th day of a hunger strike. What's the situation of Adnan and other long-term hunger strikers?
The hunger strikers in Israeli prisons, and by the way, you know, hunger strikes have been repeatedly conducted by the detainees, demanding basic rights that should be granted to them without having to go on hunger strikes. But repeatedly, Israel keeps violating its own agreements with the detainees, agreements that are reached after extended hunger strikes. This detainee, Adnan Shanaita, 25 years of old age, was moved to an Israeli hospital due to a sharp deterioration in his health condition following 38 days of hunger strike. His detainee, his condition sharply deteriorated, and he required hospitalization. And we hope that his situation would improve. But it's part of ongoing struggle of Palestinian detainees, and it's specifically also the struggle of detainees held under arbitrary administrative detention orders without charges or trial, as they those orders against them keep being renewed by a military judge or a prosecutor, and then they just never know when or if they will be released.
Have the hunger strikes had any impact on changing the conditions inside of the prisons for the Palestinian prisoners?
Yes, in many cases, you know, the detainees, through their strikes, managed to compel Israel to respect some of their rights and show a little bit improvement in their living conditions. But the problem is that Israel keeps backing down after an agreement is reached, and then you know, they agree on certain issues, including the right, you know, to family visits, and then visits will happen, and some conditions would improve, but then again and again, Israel backs down and reimposes its illegitimate policies on those detainees.
I understand that it was the issue of the planned release of prisoners that actually led to the breakdown of the so-called peace talks that were taking place recently. What was the role of that, of the prisoners and the planned release in that breakdown?
Well, that was one of the important aspects. Israel vowed to release all veteran detainees who have been held since before Oslo, the first Oslo agreement of 1993. Now, those detainees were around 126 prisoners and were supposed to be released on four stages. Now, Israel released three stages, and then they backed down on the fourth and final stage, as they promised, as part of the package deal to ensure the resumption and continuation of peace talks with the Palestinian Authority in the West Bank. That was one of the important aspects of the issue, but of course not the main issue. I mean, we have we have ongoing violations, ongoing settlement construction and expansion activities. There are many factors that led to the collapse of the talks as part of the so-called peace process that the United States have been involved in an attempt to, you know, put both parties on track, as at the same time the U.S. continues its support to Israel and its illegitimate settlement activities. Therefore, you know, the Palestinians don't trust the U.S. as a fair mediator.
So you hold, and it sounds like other Palestinians also hold, that the United States is unable to be a fair arbiter in this conflict and be the mediator in the peace talks?
The U.S. cannot be seen or viewed as a fair mediator in direct talks, in peace talks in the Middle East. Practically all of Israel's settlements that are illegal under international law and under the Fourth Geneva Convention have been paid for by the United States. Military assistance, U.S. military assistance to Israel. If you look at it, the U.S. is actually, you know, sponsoring this illegitimate Israeli military occupation of Palestine.
The peace talks have failed at this point. There's no real chance to get them back on track. As a Palestinian journalist there, is there anything that gives you hope as to something that will bring peace and justice to the region?
Well, we hope that, you know, if we are to bring peace to the region, there has to be international and especially Israeli and American recognition of the Palestinian rights. The problem here is that throughout peace talks that started initially in the early 1990s, there have been no Israeli recognition of the legitimate Palestinian rights. The Palestinians, back then the Palestinian Liberation Organization, was required to recognize Israel, and it did. But on the other hand, there have never been any official Israeli recognition of the Palestinian right in their own land, like the right to build an independent state, like the right of the refugees, the right of return, also guaranteed by various United Nations resolutions. Israel has never recognized this right, and all other rights that the Palestinians have. So if we want to build peace, we have to touch the basic and core issues of the conflict. Israel doesn't seem to be willing to recognize any of the Palestinian rights, and they are engaging in a political process that have been extended repeatedly. And since the first day of direct talks or secret talks in the early 1990s, until now, we have seen a boom, a massive increase in settlement, construction, and expansion activities on Palestinian lands that are supposed to be subject to final status agreement between Israel and the Palestinians. And then they started building the apartheid wall. So we are talking about an Israeli withdrawal from the occupied territories. By international law, Israel should withdraw from all of the occupied territories, including occupied East Jerusalem. But when you look on the ground, you see that the Palestinian territories have been fragmented and isolated by the apartheid wall and by the settlements. And now the Palestinians have isolated areas that they are supposed to control, and even those areas that are under Palestinian Authority control, the Israeli military continuously invades them, demolishes homes, kidnaps Palestinians. So there is no change on the ground, and there is no official Israeli recognition of any of those rights.
Wow. Is there anything that people in Portland can do to educate themselves and to get involved in bringing justice to the Palestinians?
Of course, people around the world and in Portland can help advance the cause, can read about what is happening in Palestine. They can always refer to our website, the International Middle East Media Center. They can also read information by the Palestinian Center for Human Rights and by many other international groups that are actually working in Palestine so they can see and witness what is happening to the Palestinian people. And yes, everybody can help in their own way. You can contact your legislator, your senator. You can, put pressure. If you are in the U.S., you can put pressure on those elected officials to tell them, this abuse to human rights cannot continue. And since the U.S. Gives Israel billions of dollars each year, then it is actually running this illegitimate military occupation, the Israeli occupation of Palestine. And the Americans should say to their government, not in our name, don't be part of this occupation, and instead work for a real and comprehensive peace in the Middle East. As we know, most conflicts over there are, in a way or another, related in the core to the Palestinian-Israeli conflict. And if the U.S. wants to achieve peace in that region, it must act on ending this illegitimate Israeli occupation of Palestine.
Well, thank you so much. I've been speaking with Syed Banora, the editor-in-chief of the International Middle East Media Center. More information and that prisoner document can be found on their website, imemc.org. Thanks for joining us today, Syed.
Thank you. My pleasure.
This is Jenka Soderberg with KBOO News.
His eyes are filled with hate. He said the problem with those Arabs is they won't recognize a Jewish state. He said those Palestinians just won't come around to accepting Jewish rule on their holy ground. He said the Arabs don't